Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, welcome to Changes, the podcast where we discuss all things change. Hope you're all well. This week I have mainly been reading a proof copy of the brand new book, More Than a Woman, by Caitlin Moran, and it's been making me laugh and guffaw out loud in bed every night, and my husband's giving me weird looks. It's so good. And it has prompted me to remind you that if you haven't had a chance to listen to episode one of this series of Changes with Caitlin Moran, please go do that. You will not regret it. That's a money back guarantee. Okay, on this week's show, we're focusing on a man called Paddy. Now, let me just give you some context. I've been driving into the BBC in central London every day for the last 3 months during lockdown. At the start, it was really strange. You know, London was an absolute ghost town. There was no traffic on the roads, no people on the streets. And still now, there's a bit more traffic, but in central London, there's just no one around. But what that meant is that people who were living on the streets in central London, who are normally kind of just in the background and kind of sitting in doorways and kind of blending into the kind of fabric of the street, those homeless people are really pushed to the forefront because they're the only people on the street. So I've been noticing them way, way more and trying to find out their stories and how they got to be there and how they're coping. I've been really interested in trying to speak to someone homeless for this podcast for a while, but it's a strange situation because you by no means want to be exploitative. You want to make sure you're speaking to someone who is happy to talk about their experiences and is kind of trained to talk about their experiences without it being triggering or kind of painful for them. So we went through a charity called Shelter and we found this man called Paddy. Paddy was homeless for 5 years, born in London, but as you'll hear, now lives in Birmingham. And Shelter connected us up. He's still in contact with Shelter, still works for Shelter as a peer mentor, as you'll hear all about. And we chatted over Zoom. Paddy is an extraordinary man to have come through all the adversity in life that he's come through. I hope, like me, you will be moved by his story. And just a little heads up about this conversation, Paddy talks openly about violence, about abuse, and about drugs. So if any of that is triggering for you, just be warned now. All right, into the podcast, Paddy. Okay, Paddy, we're going to start at the very start. This podcast is all about change and the changes that we go through in life and how we come out the other side of them. And you've had your fair share of that. But let's start at the very beginning. So where did you grow up?
I can remember early, like growing up in London with my mum and her partner at the time. And I was only a baby and she had twins, my half brothers. I'm mixed race. My family's predominantly English and Irish. So at an early age, I can remember living in flats and being locked in a bathroom. I believe it was by my, so it would have been my stepdad. I've never called him that, but I think that's what you'd call him. Yeah, and that was his form of punishment. If I was naughty or if I cried, I'd just lock him in the bathroom. And I think on the back of that, he was aggressive to my mum as well. And she was only younger, so, and she was an alcoholic. And I think my nan took me out of that situation at the age of about getting on for three, two and a half, three. And brought me back to Birmingham. So basically, I grew up with my nan and my granddad. They had 16 children. I grew up in a busy house. My granddad was really strict. He was a good man. He was a religious man. And they brought me up as a Catholic. I look at it now, and it's so multicultural and all that. But when I grew up, it wasn't like that. You know, where I grew up, there was a lot of racism. Anyway, I remember we moved to this new house. My granddad, you know, he was really bad. One of my uncles was staying there. In the end, basically, my granddad went into an old people's home. You know, we couldn't look after him.
Yeah.
And my nan was out visiting one of my other uncles who was in prison at the time, and I was left in the house with my Uncle Philip. I had a little pup. I had a dog at the time, and I got my little pup. And my uncle Philip was hitting the pup anyway. He was a bit of a, he used to beat all his wives up, and that his woman beat my uncle was. And I said, Philip, leave my dog alone. Leave my dog. Please leave him. And anyway, he got up. He said, who are you talking? And he beat me up. He stamped all over my head, broke my nose, and I was only 13.
Oh,
and the police come and all that. And they took me, and they took me for photographs. And at the time, it was like, you know, I can't grass, you know, I can't get my uncle in trouble because that's how I got kind of loyal to my family. And that was kind of my life. And I got batterings off a few of my uncles because my granddad had gone. You know, he couldn't protect me no more. And I was a bit cheeky, I'll agree. You know, I was a little, you can't do that. You can't touch me. You know, I was a little bit cheeky, I'd say. But not to the extent where to what Philip done to me. And I think from then, really, I'll be honest with you, I think I started just to stay away from home. I used to go out and hang around in gangs. I didn't go to school because I suffered, like, in school, I didn't get on. I went to a new school in a new area. It was racist as well. At school, it was racist. But they called me, like, a little packy and that. And I'm not even a... I grew up English, you know. I couldn't... I didn't know any other culture, and I was a Catholic. But because I was in this white area, no one knew me, and I was new to the area. I really struggled.
Yeah.
And I remember I used to wag school and go fishing over the lake. And my school would be out on the canoes in this lake. It was really strange. You know, and I remember one day I was going fishing. I bumped into the school board woman. She was going to take my nan to court. And I had to go to a key centre. But I wasn't bad. You know, I was just, I suppose it was escaping situations. Yeah. And,
so you were a teenager then?
I was a teenager, like, it was like I just had discomfort from when my granddad died, and I started getting into trouble with the police and, you know, just for daft things. And in the end, it was like with the gangs around my area, if you can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how it was for me. I started a job, I got a job when I was 16. I thought, you know, I wasn't stupid. I was 16 and I sent off a provisional driving licence. And I'd always been called all the way through school. My name was Patrick Burke. That was my name. You know, and I sent off for this provisional licence and it come back and it says, look, you're not known, you know, we've got no log of your name. And I went to my nan and I said, look, nan, what's going on? Look, it's saying I'm not even known. She kind of looked at me like, oh, like really, like, you know, sympathetic to me. And she's gone, come on. And she gave me a letter and it was in National Insurance number and it's got my real name on it, which they refused to call it, man, because
what
my granddad didn't like it. My name's Royston.
And your granddad didn't like that name?
No, they didn't call him in. They called me Patrick. They did. And I never knew, you know, and I swear I never knew.
Wow. Your mum called you that. Obviously
yeah, and even when I got...
Royston.
It sounds mad, because I got in bits of trouble in Chardend as a kid, where I grew.
Yeah.
And obviously I give my name as Patrick. And now when I get, like, a record check, it comes up that I gave an alias name, but that's what I thought my name was. You know, I wasn't trying to hide. So I didn't even know my name. It was strange.
Where was your mammy in all this time? Was she still down in London?
She lived in various parts of Birmingham in the end. She come back to Birmingham. This guy had left her, or they'd split up, and she was a really bad alcoholic. So in the end, I had twin brothers 2 years younger than me, and I had a younger brother 2 years younger than them, so there's 4 years difference between my youngest brother. They was like cousins to me, so she'd come up sometimes to my nan's. I'd heard my nan say she ain't taking my son, meaning me.
Right.
And my nan would scowl her, kind of. But she'd come up and down and I'd empty her cupboards and give her some food and some money, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because Mary never had nothing. I was too scared to talk to Mary, I was. I didn't really have a relationship with her. And I didn't want to upset my nan either.
Yeah.
And I felt really uncomfortable when she come. I didn't really have a relationship with my brothers because I felt uncomfortable, you know, and I was really loyal and I loved my nan so much, you know, and I didn't want to upset her. So I never really had much of a relationship. So I started working and all that when I was about 16. And when I went to work, and I thought, I was like, yeah, I'm a man now, you know, and I was only 16. And the lads used to go out drinking, and I go out drinking with them. And, you know, and that's all I'd ever seen my uncles do. Yeah, and I had a job for 2 years. And I remember I went to, on my first holiday with one of my cousins, went to Mallorca. And when I come back, I was an alcoholic and I never realised. At that time, I still didn't realise. I'd come home and I left my job and everything, and then I started a funny life of, like, crime and stuff and trying to get by and trying to live by my wits, I think you'd call it. You know, doing a bit of crime and doing a bit of this and shoplifting and that kind of stuff. And I never really had a place in the world. I never had a father figure. I never had no one to guide me. So I looked up to certain family members, cousins. I had a cousin, she was mixed race like me. And she wasn't the most honest of people, but you know what? She had a nice life. She had a lovely home. She had kids. And it's something that I admire, because where I'd come from, my nan's house, all my uncles and that was drinkers, and they sat around the house all day drinking cans on the dole. So
right.
Yeah. It was, for me, I didn't have no one who went to work. You know, there was 16 kids. None of my family even drove a car. You know, that's how it was. I never had no aspirations at all.
Talk me through that. What was your job, and was there a decision in leaving, or did you just not show up for work one day?
So what happened, I worked in his factory and I was making windows.
Yeah.
And you know, I used to turn up every day. I didn't miss work. I used to get two buses to work. I was really good. I think I was good. But on the back of that, this cousin I used to go to, I used to go there every weekend. I used to go on my mountain bike up to her house and spend the weekends there. And I always remember that song was at the time, I'm a Dreamer. Do you remember that? Living Joy.
Yeah. Yeah.
And sometimes I babysit for my little cousins. And then I was kind of coming of age. And then sometimes I'll go out with my bigger cousin, you know, and go out clubbing. I remember I got into Coast to Coast when I was about 15. You know, it's a big nightclub, you know, it's like Coast to Coast. I thought it was bad. And then that kind of club scene was coming out. And I went on this holiday with my cousin. And her lifestyle that she lived, man, the club scene and the shoplifting. And there used to be professional shoplifters, you know. It's kind of good money, you know. You could go out with them. You could earn 100 quid a day just for holding a bag. You didn't even have to go in the shop. And it was all right. And you'd only be out for a few hours, sat in a nice car, you know, get £100. And at my job, I was only £60 a week.
Yeah.
You know, so it looked good, and that kind of life looked good. And as I said, I didn't have nothing else to look up to. I didn't have no one to guide me in life. So that was part of it. So I come off holiday, and obviously, I suppose, looking back, the thrill of the holiday and the drink and all that, and I've gone back into work. And I think I was waiting to do it anyway. I think just someone might have said something cocky to me or something. And I just said, you know what, I'm off. I've had enough. And I walked out. I think I was just looking for a reason.
Yeah.
And I think I went straight to my cousin's. I don't know. It was like, look, I've joined the club. I've left my job. I'm with you. Like, come on, what work can we get in? I remember them for years, you know, from the age of 16 up until the age of 19. I never spent one night in the house. I used to go out pubs, clubs, all the local tin-tins, all the local clubs around Birmingham, the dance clubs. You know, I used to take pills. I used to shot speed on the weekends. Not to make money, to go out clubbing. I remember Sunday mornings, I'd be standing outside the pub. There'd be none of my pals with me, but I'd stand outside the pub. I'd go and get my first pint. After all, it'd be two hands, because I'd have the shakes at 19.
Wow.
But you know what? It didn't matter, because I was all right. I wasn't like my uncles. I had all designer clothes on. I had Rockports. I was big in the game. You know, I had every designer brand you could think of.
Yeah.
You know, I was into crime. I was a bit of a geezer, I think. I had things in order. I had money there. I had my fingers in different pies. I was shotting a bit of speed. And I thought I had life boxed, to be fair. You know, I had big gold chains and all that for us. Like, you know, I really thought I was big in the game. And on the back of that, I was on the dole. My drawer, I used to go to my nan's. And I'd say, Nan, just have the drawer, don't worry. And she'd go, I'm worried about you, Patrick. I'm worried. And she'd phone me. I know you're doing drugs, she'd say. And she was right, and I was. And I'd have a tear in my eye. But, you know, I was happy, and I knew she was all right, because my uncles had been in and out there anyway.
On this podcast, we always ask people for the biggest change they went through in their childhood. And we're still in your childhood, technically, I guess,
as a teenager. The biggest change, I went back home to my nan out of guilt, out of, you know, all that kind of stuff. Went back home to my nan's. I still had a bit of a drink problem, you know, but I was managing. I got a job straight away. Went back into the window trade. And I was all right, and I was all right for a bit. And I started to link up with my brothers. They'd come down and see me, you know. Got a bit of relationship going with my brothers. Got them a job at this factory as well, where I worked. So four of us was all working in these factories together. One of my brothers at the time then started on using this thing. And I'd heard of it in the past, and I'd had a little taste of it, but I'd never done it. It's called heroin. And I had a smoke of this stuff called heroin. And it's like, you know, I'd done a lot of drugs over the years. And basically what had happened over the several months, the heroin had took over from drink, from this and that. And I was using my wages to fund it. That was the biggest change. I was a heroin addict. That was at the age of 19. By the age of 22, I was on a methadone prescription. I wasn't working and I'd left my job. That life of crime that I'd kind of got out of and started working, I had to, without the comfortability of my cousin helping me and giving me £100 a day, I used to have to substitute my own habit. And because I wasn't working, it was through petty crime, like shoplifted. As minimal crime as I could do to get the shortest prison sentence, which over the matter of 10 years, I was in and out of prison. I can't even remember how many times, just short sentences, anything from 2 weeks to 9 months, you know?
Yeah.
To 18 months, I think was the highest, most sentence I got, just in and out.
And were you still using in prison, or were you
not really, bits and pieces, but coming out and not being able to wait for the day that I could pick up again back on the street, it just was non-stop, and I never knew nothing. I never had no guidance around it. I'd go days without it. I'd go like 3 days, and I think, you know, I was really happy, and I'd try and do all good, and I'd, you know, be doing all the right stuff. But on the back of this, I was still trying to help my nan go in post office for her, doing the shopping for her. You know, yeah. So even though I was on heroin and whatever, and I was a baghead, I was all right, man. You know, yeah. I never stole from my home, and I looked at it from my nan. I wouldn't let none of my uncles take the piss with her, you know, because they were still drinkers and that. So I was still kind of holding it together. Even though I was in and out of the nick, and that was the other thing that done me in the end. I couldn't, you know, sick of my nan coming to see me at the prison. But I had a relationship with my brothers as well through using heroin. I got to know my brothers so much through using heroin together.
That's mad, yeah.
And do you know what? I can honestly say, if I look back, we had some laughs. So, like, we'd start shoplifting. And I know I couldn't shoplift, but you know what? I was one of the goodest shoplifters in the end. I was all right, man. Me and my brother Neil, we'd do the shoplifting. We'd get me over two brothers to, you know, be a bit sussy in the shop so we could have it. You know, just go over there, knock some rack over, and me will have it in this corner. And then what would happen? If it come on top, it just did be four of us. So in the end, like the one day, we was getting the chase from a security guard. I said, come on, lads, what are we doing? There's four of us. We just turned around, then the security guard run off from us. It was like something out of a film.
But he ran away from you.
The security guard ran from us. Don't forget, there's four of us, you know.
Okay.
And that's how it got in the end. And then some days we go in the shop and say to the security guard, listen, mate, just do one. You know, we're having it. We need that fix. It's simple as that. And that happened loads of times.
Yeah. So did your brothers end up addicts as well?
Yeah, we was all heroin addicts, four of us.
Right.
Four of us with heroin addicts, all using together. And then eventually using intravenously, you know. All cooking off the same pot, four of us. So a few times I've been in and out with my brothers, locked up, padded up together, you know, shipped from Stafford to the Green. They didn't like you being padded up together, shipped to different prisons. And that was that life. And I remember I come to a stage where all of my brothers was locked up. I was that well known by West Midlands Police and by every shop. I was banned from every department store in the country, and I still am. And I couldn't go nowhere, and I was just stuck on my own, and I was rattling my head off one day. And I had an old mobile phone on me. And I went into this pub. I thought, if I can just sell this phone just to fix myself, you know.
Yeah.
And I've seen this van outside, and it was a window van. It was for a company that the first company I ever worked for when I left school. That job that was there. I just walked out of after my holiday. And I seen the job, and I said, all right, Irish. His name's Irish. I said, you know, I've got this phone. And he's gone. Basically, bought the phone off me for 15 quid. I got chatting to him. I said, you got any work? I was that so desperate I wasn't wanting to work again.
Yeah.
And he gave me a couple of days' work. And when he was fitting the windows, he took me back to this factory, but it had moved area, but it was the same factory that I used to work for. And they all kind of, you're back. You know, we'd always knew we'd see you again. You was a great worker. Basically offered me a job. Even though it had moved area, I used to have to get free buses to work to get to that job. And I lasted at that job on a heroin and in the end, alcohol. I was an alcoholic and a heroin addict. For 10 years, I lasted in the same job.
Wow.
Yeah. Forged my bus pass to get to work, you know, because I'd have more money for heroin.
And were you still living with your nan in the same house?
I was still at my nan's. I was a fool to myself, you know. That was the only person I was hurting through it.
Yeah.
You know, I'd come home from work, I'd get my fix, get my cans and go and isolate in my room. I thought I was big in the game because I wasn't going to prison no more.
Yeah.
You know, I thought I'd made it in life. So it was a slow change. My nan was getting really old, you know, she was in her 90s. One of my uncles basically decided to come in and buy the house because she'd been a council tenant for so long. You know, there's a few quid to be made here, you know, 80% discount on the house, you know.
Yeah.
So somewhere along the line, he told the local council that I didn't live there. So basically, I got kind of kicked out of the house, really, pushed out without actually realising it. And what happened?
And where did your nan go? What happened to everyone else in the house?
We moved her into an old people's home.
Oh, my God.
I ended up homeless. This all in the same year. You want some change, all in the same year. I ended up homeless. I broke my leg. I broke my ankle. After 2 weeks, I went back to work. So obviously I needed the money for my gear.
Yeah.
And I messed my leg up even worse and ended up in plaster up to my groin. I was in a wheelchair for about 9 months. So I lost my job.
My God.
My nan had moved into an old people's home. I ended up homeless. And my nan died. I ended up living in hostels in the Birmingham city centre. And, all right, you could call me a junkie. But I wasn't a homeless junkie. I thought I was not better than. I just hadn't lived like that before. I hadn't been a homeless person. You know, I wasn't like a street kind of person who sat begging and all that.
Mm.
And I ended up in a predicament where I was a homeless person. I was just a homeless junkie. All in a matter of 12 months. I remember being in the doctors, in a wheelchair and headbutting the wall and going, please, crying. And I was in these hostels and he was putting me in with sex offenders. And this went on for ages. I lived in about 60 hostels, more than that. I've even lost count. It's over 60, though.
Over and 60 just, hostels? In how long?
Over about 3 years.
So they just move you constantly. Why would they move you?
I was doing two, three a week hostels. I ain't living here. I'm fucking living here. I'd be like that. No chance. I'm doing it.
You'd go there and it would be so horrible. You'd say, I need to go somewhere else. And they'd move you somewhere else. It's not even horrible.
So at the time, I was going through so much pressure. And on the back when my nan died, right, two of my uncles died just in that same couple of months. But they're my brothers, you know, my uncles.
Jesus.
And I know there was boozers and that. Like one of my uncles, I was really close to my uncle's man. I like Aunt Michael, my man, he died. My head fell off, you know? Died of cancer and that.
Michael was your uncle?
One of my uncles, he was like my brother, you know?
So two uncles who were like
died
brothers.
Died in the same week in Highlands Hospital. Both on different wards. Died in the same week. And that burnt me out. And then we had to keep that secret from my nan because that would have killed her. And then she died anyway.
Oh, God. And then in the same time, you're completely displaced, chucked out of your house.
Well, I never had nowhere to live. I lost all my clothing, all my possessions. My head was shot, you know.
And your job.
I lost my job, you know. That was my form of income. I basically ended up homeless with this girl, going from hospital to hospital. And it wasn't really a relationship. I think codependency thing with each other.
You said you'd never lived like that before. You've always had a roof over your head.
Do you know, at that time, my head was that burnt out. And my nan really hurt me, that. As I'm talking to you, you know, I'm filling up with it because when my nan died, it was so strange. I couldn't, you know, she was my world, you know.
She was
my rescue. She was my only. My nan was everything to me.
Yeah.
And, that was hard for me to deal with. And that made me use more drugs. And there was this thing out what all the homeless people were smoking. It's called Spice, I think they call it Mamba.
Yeah.
And I ended up on the Mamba as well. So I had another addiction. I was on the drink. You know, I was on 130 mil of methadone at the time and I had all these drugs just holding me together. That was the only way I can explain it. It was holding me up every day, making me the way I was, you know, just trying to be on that. I had so much aggression inside me. And I don't know, I think I was just scared.
So you had 3 years in hostels?
Yeah. And then what had happened, I'd end up on the streets, I'd walk out, I'd end up having to rough it for a few nights. You know, I tried to go into the job centre and they said, I tried to sign on. I had an appointment, but because I was on crutches, they wouldn't allow me to sign on. And I said, well, why can't I sign on? They said, because you're not fit for work. And I said, well, I've been in a wheelchair for the last 3 months going around fixing locks. So, I'm fit for work, which is what I was doing. I was still doing bits of work in my wheelchair, pulling it up around the corner from the house and then limping around and fixing locks and that, trying to earn money to get my heroin. Basically, I was kicking off in the housing because they wouldn't house me. I said, I've been a council tenant all my life and you've just made me evicted. My nan's died. I got evicted from the housing, from the job centre. I couldn't conduct myself properly. I couldn't, you know, express myself
with
people. You know, and people wasn't understanding of the way what was going on for me.
Did you end up on the streets for...
Loads of times I was on the streets. Yeah. So in the end, do you know what happened? So... My brothers, let me come back to my brothers. So I had my brothers. Over them 10 years I was working in that factory,
yeah,
I lost track of my brothers, you know. I just lost track of them. One of my brothers died. One of my brothers dead. It's about 10 years ago in a cemetery in Handsworth. He'd been dead for 9 months. He was a skeleton. The police wouldn't release his body for 12 months because autopsies and all that kind of stuff. And they believe he overdosed, to be fair. I think that's what happened.
Oh my God, that's so sad.
When we buried him, my other two brothers, one was in Blake and Hurst. One was in Winton Green. So when we buried him, there was obviously my two brothers come from different prisons with screws, cuffed with screws. It was a funny old, you know, funeral. So this is what happened. So when I was homeless, there's a place in town where it prescribes methadone and stuff to help you with drugs and all that kind of stuff. So that was in the city. So my younger brother got clean and he started working there.
Yeah.
And in there, they also do housing and all that. They're trying to help you with housing. So what I used to do is every night, I used to sleep under the subway outside this building. Go there for a coffee and to try and get housing that day, you know.
Yeah.
And I'd see my brother outside and I'd say, oh, Nick, take that. I said, give me a coffee. And I'd hand him a can of special brew because I'd always have a can. And I'd say, get rid of that. And I'd have my coffee off him. And I think it was a bit of a cry for help to him, you know.
And was he nice to you?
Yeah, man. No, Nick is good. Beautiful, man. He's a good kid. Really good.
And so did he help you get the housing?
So he was on a different department, but he said, Pad, he said, when you want to give up, because ultimately, I was a homeless addict. So
yeah.
Homelessness and addiction, they normally go hand in glove, you know?
Yeah.
So I think a lot of my problems was the addiction. In these hostels that they put you in, they say they're hostels, right? Before you move in, there's one thing that you need first. You have to be on benefits, you know, even though it's supported. So they won't support you to get on benefits. Give me your benefits, your national insurance number. You don't never see them again. You're given a room and that's it. And then maybe once a week they come and check to see if you're alive, you know?
Yeah.
And then, so there's no actual support there, but it says supported accommodation. That's what they get paid for from the government for, to support you.
But okay, so supported accommodation, it's just a room.
You got a room, and you know what? If you're lucky, you might have electric, you know? And you might, right. you'll have electric normally.
Yeah.
But that's it, you know? So you get a mattress. Don't mean to say you're going to get sheets with it, but you've got a mattress. But not all of them are like that. The majority are in the city. So that's what I was dealing with every day. And imagine with 30 rooms in, and everyone's got a drug addict in it. So you can imagine you're just left to your own devices. So what I found was I was easier on the streets to try and get clean and that kind of stuff. I was easier sleeping under the subway because I didn't have people knocking on my door all night, kicking my door in. Constant battling, people asking if I had drugs, do I want drugs, do-do-do-do-do. It just kept me away from it.
God, yeah.
So that was my life for ages, in and out. And try getting clean in that environment, you know.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah.
And then imagine being took seriously if you're a drug addict and you want to try and step out of that and then get your own property. Well, you're a drug addict, mate, you know. How could you look after your own property? Which they're right. But you see, there's no move out of it. It's just you're stuck in a trap.
Yeah. What did you find on the streets in terms of just talking about what it's like to be on the streets? Like, so the hostels, where the kind of chaotic, really unsafe places. But on the streets, what was that like for you? And what did you discover about people when you were on the streets?
So I've been to some hostels and a lot of the lads that get bought through begging, like, I tried it, but I couldn't do it. I'd never, you know, got a bit of change, mate, all that. But I just couldn't do it. I don't know what it was. I wasn't better. It wasn't above it. I just never had it in me. I wasn't skilled at blagging people for money, where some of my mates was. So the city wasn't no good for me. That homeless thing wasn't no good for me. And I'm more of a person that wants to support myself. I don't want to beg off people. I want to get better. The city and that homeless stuff was a phase for me, and I needed to get out of it. So really, there's some people in that city or around the city, and they're happy with that homelessness and that, you know, don't pay taxes and all that. That suits them. It didn't suit me. And there is a lot of help out there for people. I'll be honest, there's agencies to help. So what used to happen, obviously you spend your money on drugs. So what happened to me was one of the biggest changes that come in my life was I was sat up this place called in Burnley City Centre. It's on every night. It's called the Food Run. So it's where people come out and give food, and they give hot food and curries and all that. You know, Indian churches are really big for it. They feed hundreds. Anyway, I'm sitting up this Food Run and this lady's come over to me. And she's going, all right, mate, what you doing? You're like, she's basically trying to chat to me. You know, one of the do-gooders with the badges on.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I class them as, you know. She had this badge on. I'm like, all right, love, you know, just, it's nice to talk to someone kind of normal sometimes.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
And I'm humouring her, you know, and she's asking me about myself, and I was having a good old chin wag with her. It's really nice. So anyway, she got this badge on. It's for a charity called Shelter. I'd heard of it. I don't know. I think I've seen it on the telly, but I never knew it. And she was saying, well, I'm a peer mentor. I work for Shelter. And she explained what a peer mentor was. I'd never heard of it. Do you know what one is?
Tell us.
Okay, so she's explained this. She said, well, a peer mentor, what I do is I've got lived experience. I thought she'd probably caught the bus once, you know, something like that. Lived experience. That's what I thought. I don't know what kind of experience she's talking about, you know, what you lived. I thought she might have been on the dole once, maybe. And she started telling me a bit of her story. And the story was like addiction, shoplifting, all that.
So familiar things to you.
Apart from the prostitution.
I
really identified with everything apart from that. But obviously it's a circle that I'd come out of. And as she's talking to me, my jaws dropped. I kind of filled up inside and I'm thinking, I'm looking at her and I'm looking at her clothes and I'm looking at the way she carries herself. And I'm in my head, I'm thinking, I never would have guessed. And do you know when you know someone's not lying to you? You can just tell. It's just natural. And the things she said, and she spoke the same as me. And I knew she'd got the same education as me on the streets, I could tell.
Yeah.
And she told me and how she got clean and how she come through it. So, because as I said, a lot of my stuff, it was homelessness, but it was addiction. Now, she basically told me that she'd gone through all that. She got clean. She'd gone through a really bad, violent relationship. From homelessness, she got herself clean off the street. She started doing voluntary. She started working as a peer mentor, which is a start, you know, to normal living. It's a bridge to normal living. Where I'd come from and the area I grew up in, no one ever got clean. You either went to prison, or if you did get clean, you normally sell drugs, or then if you didn't sell drugs, you normally die. You know, there's not much other stuff you can do where I come from. No one gets clean unless maybe you've probably got thousands of pounds to go into rehab. These meetings kept happening about this is going on over a couple of weeks. And basically she started supporting me and she signed me up with Shelter.
Wow.
And she got me in an accommodation and I refused to live in there. I didn't live in there. So we had our highs and we had our lows.
What was the accommodation?
Do you know where it was? It was an old police station. And I've gone in there and they said, you're on benefits. And I thought, here we go.
And so you weren't on benefits?
No, I was. I thought, on benefits. Yeah. The minute you said you want benefits, that's when you know you're not getting supported.
Yeah.
Because my point being, it shouldn't matter whether you're on benefits or not. If you go into a place and you're not on benefits and it's a supported accommodation, they should say, okay, no problem, sit down and we'll get you sorted.
Yeah. Do you see? We'll support you to get benefits.
We'll support you to get it. The thing is, they want you to sign you over to your benefits, claim £200 to £300 a week for you. You know, to give you a room. So he's giving me my key, giving my national insurance number, and he's directing me down these corridors. And do you know what it was? It was an old police station and it was a police cell.
Oh, my God.
It was an actual police cell with them food mattresses on. And I said, listen, mate, what if someone shuts the door and he's going to just ring the bell?
So basically, you put me in jail for the night.
Yeah, so it was an emergency support accommodation. And I didn't stay there. I don't even think I went back and took him the key back.
So did you go back to the streets that night then? You went and slept
rough? Think I slept in someone's... I found an old car and I slept in that, I think. Basically, I went back to Shelter kicking off. I said, yeah, fucking put him in a police station, you know? And I was a bit aggressive and da-da-da. But not with Colette, I wasn't. I was a bit vocal with her. I was never aggressive. Yes, and I think she found me somewhere else and then... After a bit, I got some rapport with Colette and I started to trust her with some stuff, you know, and I told her about my family and I had a lot of resentments on my family, you know, because when my nana died, my family, I classed at the time, there was like vultures, they took everything, you know, and I never had nothing from my nana, I never even had a picture of her.
And
you know, it kind of hurt me. I had a lot of resentments, but anyway, Colette phoned one of my aunties and basically she wanted me to go into rehab. She'd spoken to me about it and as I said, I never heard of it. I thought you needed money. Colette was putting in for me for rehab and she got one of my aunties to put me up on her settee, basically. She got kids and all that my aunt had.
Yeah.
And my aunt put me up and tolerated me being an alcoholic and I was smoking Mamba still at the time. I wasn't injecting heroin. I was on my methadone.
Yeah.
She tolerated me for about 2-3 months. And I mean, when I say I was hard work.
Right.
You know, I was just hard work. I was a drunk. I was basically like one of my uncles at my nan's house. If I look back now, that's what I was like.
Of course, okay, yeah.
And she put me up, you know. And then I remember her and her husband dropped me to rehab. This would have been 4 years ago. And I went in there to come off the drink, everything. And I went in there with a £10 Mamba because, remember I said all them drugs was holding me together.
Yeah.
And when you go into this rehab, all you get is one tablet a day. Diazzi, and I knew what I was going to get. And I knew, because I've been a drug addict so long, I knew that wouldn't hold me together. So I had to go in, and every day for the 2 weeks, I had to have two drugs of Mambri in the morning, and that kept me head together. That was confined. Then they move you to another rehab, which you allowed out, and I was in the next one for 3 months.
Wow.
And I come off the drink, I did. But I was still smoking Mamba, but crafting being that I was, they couldn't test you for the Mamba because it's untestable.
Oh, so, God.
But the thing was, so I'm trying to tell you the positive from this. I got off the drink and the drink was killing me, my livers and everything was growing.
So that's such a huge change for you, for the first time in your life actually having to try and like overcome the drinking. Was it hard?
Yeah, so I felt like crying because there was little Tesco's down the road from the rehab and we was allowed out and I had to go in and my drink of choice was Special Brew. And I was on like 12 of them a day before I went into rehab. I was shaking for nearly 3 months and I had to go in there nearly crying and I had to wave at the Special Brew to say bye to them. You know, it's a thing what they do in rehab, you know. Just say goodbye to it.
Yeah.
And I did. Basically, I got kicked out on the new year, you know.
Of the rehab?
Yeah, I got kicked out on the new year for smoking Mamba. Someone grassed me up.
Right.
I remember I got into a supported housing at the time, and it wasn't too bad, this supported housing. And I was still smoking the Mamba. And I started doing these things called meetings, like where you've got AA, NA and all that.
Yeah.
And I started to get a bit of awareness around addiction, which is something I never had. I never knew, you know. I knew have a drink or I don't have a drink, get clean. I never knew the awareness with behaviours and you know, all that kind of stuff. I never had no awareness of addiction. They all seem really happy. They seem to me like they're still on drugs because was that happy, you know, these people in these organisations. But I knew they wasn't, you know what, because my younger brother used to go to them. In the end, what I did was I was smoking this Mamba. I was back on my methadone again, but half the dose I was on before. So, do you know what? I'm getting kind of better here.
Yeah.
And what I was doing then, I started selling Mamba to buy my heroin every day. And it sounds really bad, but my head was gone because I had a bit of this nice recovery for 3 months and life was looking good. And, you know, I'm learning about personal development and feelings and having a conscience and... And then I'm battling away with trying to sell drugs to feed my habit again. And I've got two different things fighting away at me.
So what made you change your life in the end? What was the turning point for you to actually change your life?
So this was the change. Talking to that lady.
Colette.
She brings tears to my eyes as well. Tears of joy. Because if I never met her, and I'm not advertising Shelter. She worked for Shelter. So obviously I am, but I ain't. So I don't mean it as an advertisement. But if I never met Colette and that project that was going on, it was lead worker, peer mentor. If I never come across that project, I wouldn't even be here now. You know what? I guarantee you I'll be dead. So she changed my life because she gave me a message that, you know what, recovery is possible. And then from recovery, I managed to turn my life around. So what happened from that day... I knew, and Colette was in my head all the time. She showed me what to do. All you got to do is do it, Paddy. All you got to do is do it. So the stuff was laid out for me by her. I just needed to take it. So that Christmas, I went to Mary's, which is my birth mum. I knocked on her door in the middle of the night, Christmas Eve. And I said, Mary, please can I stay? I want to get clean. And she's gone, you can come in, Patrick. But she said, you can't use drugs in my bathroom, which I'd done on loads of times. You know, when I wasn't in them on, I said, please, mate, I swear I'm serious. She let me stay there over the Christmas, and I never used. I went and got a taxi to get my methadone because I was too scared to walk the streets in case drug dealers stopped me and approached me for drugs, to offer me drugs.
Yeah.
And I was really serious, you know. And I just something twitched in me. And it, as I said, I don't know if it was a breakdown. I just had enough, and it was all reflection on Colette and, you know, what Colette had done for me, which hence was Shelter. But it was Colette as a person. I'd had over 50 support workers in my life, but I never had a support worker like Colette.
Yeah.
I'd never come across that who'd give me a wall, give me a hole. She'd give me everything, you know, about herself, which you get a normal support worker. It's not like that. You know, they just get their wages and they go home.
And is it because you knew that she had been through what you had been through?
Yeah, it was mad as well because my brother was doing the same path as what she'd done and my brother had got clean as well. Through the same path, through NA. So I stopped at Mary's for a couple of weeks and I went to these groups in the day. At that place where my brother used to work, where I used to sleep outside.
Yeah.
And that's where I used to get my methadone from. So they allowed me into their groups only because of my brother. They said, if you come and give us a negative test, you can come and reduce on your meth in this building. So every day I used to just go and give them a clean test, and I wasn't using. And I'd sit in these groups for hours for the day. They'd buy me a day saver, they'd get me a bus pass, and give me some lunch.
These groups are, these are the NAs that kind of...
No, these are not NAs. No. So this is
what are the groups?
These are like methadone reduction groups to try and get stable and, you know.
I got it, yeah.
So I remember, so this guy who run the group, Andy's name is Scouse, he's a nice guy. So at the end of the day, go, okay, everyone, so when you get home tonight, just go and write on the board what you're going to do when you get home. And I'd say to whoever sat next to me, please write on that board. Because I couldn't even get up. I was aching. You know, the methadone was coming out of the system. And
yeah.
Drugs, as I said, the drugs was only holding me up. And I'd put on the board, I just want to get home in one piece without the school kids starting on me on the bus. You know, that's where I was at. You know, mentally, I was battered.
Yeah.
You know, it was like I was 2 weeks to get home. And I got through that and I cried. My brother used to come and see me and I cried to him. I go, Nick, what am I going to do, man? What happened then? I found out about this housing called supported housing, and it was called dry houses, which means that you go in but you can't use and they test you regularly. And I thought, well, that sounds really good to me because that's what I want.
Yeah.
I moved into this supported housing. Do you know what? It was actually supported, believe it or not. You know, someone would come and check on you every day, or you could have the guy's number and he'd come and see you. And obviously you couldn't use in the house, so it was great. And I thought, well, hang on, I'm not going to have people knocking my door, whether I want this, do I want that? For 19 months I was in the houses for. And every day I was doing voluntary work. And do you know what I was doing? I was doing the same stuff that Colette taught me. She said, you know, you're on your benefits, you just get yourself stable. You know, you do the right thing, you don't take off no one, you try and give back to society. And all this stuff that Shelter had taught me, you know. And it's something that I never done. And do you know what I had to do? I didn't have to, in my head, in my conscience. I had to keep it a secret from my family that I was doing voluntary work.
Why?
Because they would have called me stupid. Because my family's kind of like that. You don't do nothing for nothing. You had to be paid for everything. And I thought, well, where's that ever got used? Like, you know, where? To be fair.
And how are you now? What's your situation?
What happened was, I was in the ACES for 19 months and I met a girl who was living in the same organisation and they kicked us both out. So I was homeless again. So this was just over 2 years ago.
And why did they kick you out?
Because we was having a relationship and in that organisation...
Oh, you're not allowed.
Relationship allowed. So that was okay. Found this little hostel thing in Acock Green and everyone was using in there again. I'd go to the toilet, there was needles on the floor. Yeah. I said, we're back, I'm back. But I never touched it and it didn't bother me. And I'd done so much work on myself and I'd been doing these meetings and, you know, I was kind of high on this thing. It's called life, you know. I was great. I was clean and I couldn't believe it. And you know what? That didn't faze me no more because I've learned so much off Colette and it didn't matter to me whether people used as long as I never. I was in this supported housing. But you know what? They actually did, even though other people was using in the house, they supported me and they supported me to get other housing. And I stayed in the house for 6 months. And in that time, I got a council proposition. And that was just over a year ago. I gained a full tenancy there. And then what happened on the back of that, because I was still doing voluntary, one of the team leaders at Shelter, she gone, Paddy, don't you think it's time you just got a job? And I went for this job as a peer mentor because I was doing that much voluntary. I had to give up my benefits. I was on really good benefits, you know. I was on this sick money and they called it mental health, but I was off my head for a while, you know, head butting walls and all that.
Yeah.
And what happened was I worked it out, but the benefits outweighed the wages at Shelter. But I thought, you know what, I'm living an honest life now. So you know what, I can cope with that. Life's not all about money. It never got my uncles nowhere. And I gave up my benefits. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And I went on to this low wage at Shelter. But it was a wage and it was all right. I was paying my bills. And then someone said, Paddy, why don't you step up? And I wasn't ready. And then I'm with this girl still. And I stayed with the girl. And about a year ago, she told me she was pregnant. And I'm 44.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no. And I thought, no. Because I thought, listen, do you know all the shit and the substances I put in my body? And you know, I thought my minerals was done. And I thought, there's no way I can have a kid. So I thought I was just done. The bird I'm with, well, Sarah, her name, she's 30. But as I said, I've got a good few years on her. So what happened was, just over 6 months ago, we had a beautiful boy. And do you know what we called him?
What?
Patrick.
Oh, Paddy, I'm gonna cry.
So we got a proper Paddy Burke now, you know? So that's what my granddad wanted. So that's what he got. And do you know where I live? You never guess.
Where?
Right over the road. So listen, I googled this. There's 250,000 postcodes in Birmingham. I live on the same one where my nan died.
Oh my God, you have such a fucking mad life.
It's mad, isn't it? So there's an old people zone where my nan died. I live just over the road. Like, if I could actually throw a stone out the window, and that's not even lying. I could just flick a penny over to her window where she passed away.
What is the best thing that a person can do when they see a homeless person on the street?
So I'm not going to tell you to approach them. You've got to remember, everybody's got their own story. You know, do you know, look, I've just told you mine, but if you see me sitting there with a can of special beer in my hand, let's say,
yeah,
and I'm 9 stone with a big beard, you just think probably, I don't know what you'd think. Just remember, everyone's got a story. You know what? I've heard a lot worse stories than mine. So everybody just needs to be aware of that. And do you know what? What did I say? Most people are only a wage packet or two away from homelessness.
More than ever.
You know, or it depends what circumstance throws it, yeah.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd end up homeless.
Did you ever give up hope of finding home? Like, when you were in your darkest days, did you ever believe that you'd end up to be able to be doing what you're doing now?
Do you want the truth? I thought I would just die on the streets. Yeah, I thought I'd die. And do you know what? Colette says to me, no, Paddy, you've done it yourself. All right, and I get that, but that's like saying we go to school and we learn maths. I know we do it ourselves, but unless someone taught us how to do it,
yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was Colette who taught me how to live. That's the truth.
How has the experience of living in that kind of chaotic world of hostels and rough sleeping, how has that stayed with you?
So obviously I see it every day because all my clients are in the same position.
Yeah.
So, all right, I can get a good rapport with my clients because I know where they're at. I can talk to them straight. I'm like, you know, I can talk to them properly.
Yeah.
Boundaries are a little bit hard sometimes because I'm so close to them on a level where I've been there. So that's something I'm still working on daily.
Being able to walk away and go back to being, I get it. Having boundaries in place, it's a bit tough sometimes
because sometimes I can forget how much I've grown. I can forget about all that and put myself still on the level with them because they are me. I'm no different to them. And I'll never forget where I come from.
Yeah. Can it be emotionally draining going back to those places and seeing people in the states that you were once in?
I don't like seeing it. I tell you a thing I don't like to see around the city, and a lot of it goes on, is the bullying. I don't like it. I'm not happy about it. And that happens to some, a lot of my clients. They
get bullied by people on the street?
No, other adults, vulnerable adults, taking the piss. You know, just bullies, because don't forget, homeless people are the most vulnerable adults. You know,
the most vulnerable.
So you've got bullies out there. People who do live in places, and they'll take their money off and take their benefits off them. And it's not great, you know. It's not a person who does that to another person to prey on the weak. It doesn't sit good with me.
How has becoming a daddy changed you?
So it's mad because I never thought, I'm 44, you know. So do you know what I've had to even do? I'm wounded. I had to stop smoking. But you know what? I wanted to stop smoking for ages. But then before he was born, I was on the bus and I seen this geezer with his two kids. And he was about my age. He even looked like me, and he was coughing and spluttering. He must have been taking his kids to school. And I thought, I ain't having that. I can't be like that. Yeah. You know, I thought if that man took me to school, I'd be so embarrassed. So from seeing that man, it just gave me a little inkling. I'll stop smoking. I'm on one of these little puffer things now. It's not a vape. It's it's like a white thing. You get it from the chemist, and you just put like a little nicotine cartridge in. It looks like a little Tampax.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I've stopped smoking. I haven't had a fag now for about 8 months.
God, Paddy, you got no vices left.
Bad, you know, it's terrible.
It's good.
No, it's good, but like, do you know what as well? When I first, 3 and a bit years ago, I was 9.5 stone. I come into recovery.
I'm nearly six foot,
you know what I mean?
Because you're tall, yeah.
Yeah, I'm quite tall. So do you know, I weighed myself yesterday. Have a guess.
I don't know, 12 stone, 11 stone?
14.3.
Oh, yeah. So you're getting some good grub down your neck.
Do you know what, though? I'm not a fatty, though. I'm filled out.
Yeah.
So it's kind of going all right, you know?
You're happy. That's what it is. You're happy.
I'm content. You know, I am content.
Paddy, last question. What is the change that you are most proud of to have got through in your life?
All right. So as we spoke, a lot of it was around my addiction and copping myself on and waking up to it and realising that was keeping me out there even longer on the streets. So it was overcoming my addiction, and that was through support from Shelter and Colette. You know, if I never got into rehab and got a message of recovery and how to live a normal life and got that from them, then, you know, I would still probably be, I'd be dead now. I wouldn't even be on the streets and I'd be dead.
Yeah. Can I ask you about, I'm reading this book on addiction at the moment by this guy called Gabor Mate. I'm sure that's
Gabor,
not how you
Mate.
Pronounce it.
Yeah. Gabor Mate.
There you go. You know, have you read it?
I haven't read it. I've heard it's good, though.
It's really interesting. He talks about addiction as, you know, it's about torment and it's about pain and it's about what humans go through mentally. And, you know, you can do everything else with addiction in terms of learning methods of how to get off stuff, but you have to deal with the kind of base reasons for why you're addicted to things in the first place, as in what you went through as a person. Have you started trying to do that, like kind of deal with what you've gone through in your life, or is that something that you're going to try and do in the future? Or
I've done a lot of work on myself and obviously done NA and done shares about my past.
Yeah.
In regards to my addiction, I've gone for bits of counselling and it seems to bring up stuff like this. And as I said, I've dealt with a lot of it. You know, I do see Mary now. I still call her Mary. I can't call her mum. I feel like I'd just diss my nanny if I ever called her mum. And I don't feel like she's ever been a mum to me anyway.
And how is Mary? Is she all right in life?
She's been off the drink as well. She stopped drinking about 3 years ago as well, 4 years ago, roughly.
That's
about
great.
The same time. So she stopped drinking.
Yeah, wonderful.
I have regular contact with her. I say to him, come and see Patrick when you want. You're his nan, you know, there's no issues.
Yeah.
So I try and keep her engaged with him. And my other little brother as well, Nicholas. As I said, my brother Neil's still locked up. I spoke to him on the phone the other day. He said he's going to go straight when he comes out. And we'll help him. We'll see about that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Nicholas, he's a drug worker now. And he's got a partner in there due to have a baby as well in the next week.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So
that's
my brother's having a baby as well. So my little boy will have a little cousin.
Yeah. Oh, Paddy, thank you so much for your conversation today. It's been so interesting to hear about your life.
Oh, listen, have a good day. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you again to Paddy for telling us so patiently his remarkable story. Paddy still works for Shelter, the very charity that helped him off the streets, and with the help of Colette, of course, finally got him to see the light about his alcohol and heroin and spice addiction. If you want to support what Shelter do, and right now, they really need your help, go to shelter.org.uk, and we've put a link as well in the episode notes. So yeah, go there and see what you can do. Making this episode was a real team effort, so massive thanks to Abby Hollick, Louise Mason and Matt Hill at Rethink Audio. Next week we meet Irish author Sinead Gleeson, and she's got an incredible story to tell. Until then, take care.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.